This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Okay, there's nobody here at the moment, so I think Carly's down in the shed. Hello. Bit late this morning, sorry. Can you let me in?
Have it locked from the inside.
All right, make sure those
are
locked. Hey, how's it going?
Good to see you again.
You too. Just lock this.
You sit here.
Hang on, just lock this so we don't get any escapees, either humans or animals.
Now,
it's a bit of a... Who are you? We have a guest in here today.
Hello, I'm Rob. Rob Gandola. A lot of you will probably know me from just general Twitterage with Collie, and been one of those people that gets out and ends up in ditches and counting frog spawn mats and catching newts with Collie in the spring and surveying for lizards and all the usual fun and games that we normally get up to around here.
Sounds like a lot of fun. I've seen you on television, haven't I?
Yeah, you've seen me on telly as well. But at times, it's the bald, shiny head makes you very noticeable.
He has a face for radio. Really, to that, I'm joking.
How dare you?
So, what do you do? What's your speciality?
So, I'm a herpetologist as well. So, I'm one of these zoology people who specialises in reptiles and amphibians. I'm currently trying to finish off my PhD on Madagascan Nile crocodiles out in UCD. But, like, as I said, I've been working on research in reptiles and amphibians for nearly the last 14 years now. Everything from crocodiles to frogs, native stuff in Madagascar, Central America, the usual wide variety that keeps me out of trouble and away from the pub on most occasions, which is probably good for me.
What are we going to talk about today?
So today I think we were talking, because me and Rob primarily deal with the herpetofauna of Ireland. I was thinking we talk about amphibian collapse and the general hassle that they're going through at the moment. It's kind of a hot topic in our circles, and Europe wide there's a big issue here at the moment because of the decline in the numbers, like a proper collapse in certain individuals, particularly like fire salamanders in Central Europe and stuff like that. So we have our own populations that are claimed that they're fine, but anecdotally and especially locally we've noticed severe drops in numbers. So yeah, I think it's an interesting subject to talk about.
It's going to be a sad story.
Some success stories, but it hasn't been good since the 1980s, probably before then. It was really noticed in the 80s that they started officially seeing that populations were collapsing, like major collapses, and then some local extinctions. And then there was a bit of pushback from certain scientists saying, well, they fluctuate. But then after proper research, then they started looking at some of the funguses that were being spread around and some of the viruses that were going around different populations. And then it became a real issue, and everybody now is on the same page, more or less, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think amphibian decline globally is a massive, massive issue at the moment. So I think the best way of winning your crowd and winning people to your cause is to show you how amazing the animal that you're trying to conserve is. And with amphibians, like, there's such huge variety, like from spectacularly colourful down to like the minute. There's something there for anybody that you can kind of get them kind of interested and fascinated with, so that you can say, look, they're in trouble, but we know that if we do X and Y, it means that, you know, another number of negative factors kind of can be mitigated by doing these other things, because usually it's an additive effect that really hits them the worst rather than one thing on its own.
We found from doing public outreach that anybody who's into nature, even if slightly into nature, especially older generations, the first thing we kind of grab them by is saying, do you remember you used to collect tadpoles? And they go, oh my God.
We did too.
Yeah, and it brings them back to that kind of the little boy or girl who was out with nature and watching them grow and watching the change, the metamorphosis, and that kind of magic gets them back into it. And then you can kind of bring in the conservation angle. You go, you don't see as many nowadays. And they go, Jane, yeah, I realise that now. And it's a good in. People genuinely love these little animals, you know. There's a special place in their brains for them, in their hearts or whatever. But like, it's just, as Rob said, it's a good angle to get in and just show how amazing, how beautiful. Like our own common frog is an incredible little creature.
It's terrible that, you know, something goes to all that trouble of evolving for millions of years and then we slap the name common on it. Like anything but.
Yeah. What's their Latin name mean? Temporary frog, yeah?
Yeah, just temporary frog.
Why temporary?
Well, just because of their spawning. It's usually done over a period of yeah. 3 to 4 weeks and then they disappear.
They become
terrestrial because it's easier to see them in open waters where they normally breed. But if you take the European example and they call them grass frogs or brown frogs, you've given it a colour or you've given it a place where it's associated with to the name. So instead of being common, all the connotations with the word common never do a species any good. And it's usually those ones that have this kind of label as being a common species are usually the ones that decline massively, and it's never noticed until it's almost too late. And I think we're in danger of seeing that here, but it's not because of some of the big nasties that we're probably going to talk about, but it's because of like some of the really obvious things like habitat change, landscape use change, and that's what most people in Ireland will tell you. Like when we do the outreach events, you just say, oh yeah, that field over there is where I grew up and as a kid, and it used to be wet down the end and they used to be chock full of frogs, but then they drained it and now there's a housing estate there with 200 houses.
Yeah.
So the frogs don't come back anymore, like the habitat was taken away. You know, and that's the kind of thing, and it's fair enough if it's one case, but when you're having tens of people tell you the same story from all over the island, that's when you start to kind of get this picture that, you know, things have changed, which they will change. Like that's, you know, it's just how people are.
Rob, how many species of frogs do we have in Ireland?
So in Ireland we're very lucky in that we tend to have one of all of our amphibians, which is great. We've got one frog, one newt, one toad.
Really?
Yeah, which is great. Makes it really easy for somebody like myself and Colly to sell. You know, when you turn around, if you go to somewhere like Colombia where there's hundreds and hundreds of species of frog across multiple families and they all look weird and some of them are huge and some of them are tiny. It's a bit of a hard sell rather than there's lots of frogs and they're all wonderful. Whereas here we can go, we've got one species of frog, check this out. And yeah, fair enough, the males tend to be a bit boring, but the females are fantastic. They're so variable in their coloration. You get brick reds, yellows, greens, different tones of brown. So they're massively variable. Mm. And I think when you're trying to sell the image of something to people who wouldn't normally work with wildlife, colour is usually a really good way of doing it. You can say, look how colourful these are, or look at the amazing tones. And like, then when you throw in the common frog, grass frog, we call them grass frog, I don't like common frog, grass frog lifestyles, like they do all this crazy stuff, like they're actually pirates. So when you read all this like information on them, I'll say, like, usually your population is one male, there's one male for every one female. That's not normally the case. There's usually an excess of males at any given point in time. So the big males tend to do well because they wrestle with each other and they wrestle each other off the females in order to mate with her. And they fertilise her eggs as they squeeze them out. But what happens to the lonely boys who are very viable? They're obviously strapping, fecund males, loads of sperm, and they need something to do with it. So what they'll go in and they'll just grab hold of a big clump of spawn, which may have like 200 plus eggs in it or more, and they'll actually become pirates. They're spawn clump pirates, and they'll fertilise
over them.
Essentially, that's what they'll do. They'll go in and they will piratise the spawn, and they will mate with the clump of spawn. It's like, you know, in Family Guy when Lois gets the liposuction and Peter's in the office and he's giving it to the big bag of fat. That's essentially what they're doing. And what they're hoping there is some of the embryos will not have been fertilized by the male who was actually in amplexus with the female, and then they'll kind of fertilize the other ones, yeah. and they'll cut the missing. So you, it's likely that you get multiple fratters for every clump of spawn, which keeps them genetically healthy as well.
Insurance policy, amazing.
Absolutely, but grass frogs are the ultimate animals in insurance policies. They do so much things, like you could spend hours just talking about them, like from what their tadpoles do right up until how the adults behave to ensure that the next generation kind of gets to be recruited into the population and can go on in 2 or 3 years later to become the ones who are mating as well. It's nuts.
And how big is a grass frog?
I don't know, a big, large female, maybe kind of just shy of 10 centimetres, yeah, maybe 4 inches from the tip of the nose to the Eurostal. So the
funny thing about frogs as well is the older they are, they never stop really growing. They'll keep getting big because they get predated and nailed so much. They don't naturally live that long. Obviously, 5 or 6 years is a good age for a frog in a natural habitat, because especially around breeding season, they get hammered by everything because they've only one thing on their mind, which is doing the nasty and getting the next generation along. And while they're so focused on that, they tend to get nailed by herons, foxes, otters. Everything will eat them. It's just like a big food fest for all the predators. But in gardens where there's not so many predators, I have frogs here for 12 years.
Wow.
And I can recognise them as well. As Rob says, the females, especially the females, have different colour patterns. So you can see, I have a big girl called Big Red who comes back every year, and she's huge. And, you know, you have one with a gimpy arm or something that you remember who they are, yeah. call them different names. But, yeah, so they do get big. The big females are big enough. A substantial animal to have around your backyard, and it's kind of cool to see them, you know.
I remember collecting, as you said, collecting tadpoles when we were kids, you know. And I remember them as being really, really small. But I was up in the mountains last year, up around Glencree and beyond. And we parked the car at one of the scenic locations and took a walk back into the hills. And there was a couple of ponds full of water, just rainwater that had been there. And they were teeming with tadpoles. But they looked much bigger than I remember them when I was a kid. So maybe I just have a bad memory or...
No. Like tadpoles, I think they're so variable. Yeah. Like I've got tadpoles at home still.
Yeah.
So these massive tadpoles are the ones, for whatever reason, and it's not always environmental, just have decided not to metamorphose. So you end up the following spring with these whopper mini submarines floating around.
Really?
And then they'll metamorphose usually with the following year's next lot. But they all catch up. They come out as bigger froglets. When they metamorphose, they come out as bigger froglets.
Oh, that's amazing. So they can actually choose if conditions aren't good or something or whatever, they don't metamorphose into frogs.
Yeah, now we've tried it ourselves because we get up to all this sort of carry on just because that's how we do. I've got the beautiful IKEA ponds, which are the big plastic tubs in the garden, because we don't have a pond like Collie does. And we get spawn in there. The frogs in my garden come in and spawn in the IKEA tubs. So like they're really flexible in that way as well. So all the tadpoles are subjected to the exact same conditions, and then some will come out and go into the garden, and I've still got froglets, I've still got little tadpoles there right now.
Wow.
And they've got back legs, they haven't, the front legs have developed but they haven't ruptured through the skin yet, so they're just in under the chest. So you have these little jet black, they look very similar to fish because they're so large, and they're just swimming around now, and they will metamorphose next spring, but they'll just be slightly bigger than the normal froglets. But the next year's froglets will catch up with size, so come June, July, barring us getting another ridiculous heat wave, it all evens out. The small ones catch up eventually.
Wow.
That's, as Rob was saying earlier on, that's another insurance policy.
Yeah.
It's another little trick. So in case next year's lot get wiped out as spawn, for example, if you have a nasty frost like we did last year, you still have those tadpoles that will metamorphose and produce a certain amount of the next generation. So it's a very cool trick.
That's amazing. So what's your favourite tadpole fact or frog fact?
I like the fact that they're pirates. I like this image. I'm sitting there, Captain Jack Sparrow-esque with a little eye patch on, just being a bit weird and hanging around the water.
Actually, call them the sex pirate frog. That'd be a much better name, because people would gravitate towards that.
I guess.
Well, shiver me timbers!
They just do so many cool things, as well as like. They are a food source as well in some countries.
Yeah.
I hear, well, I suppose if you're hungry enough.
I think my one is the African bullfrog. They're the heavyweight wrestlers, the heavyweight UFC champions of frogs, because the males are actually bigger than the females, which is really unusual for frogs. Also, when they spawn, they protect the eggs. So it doesn't matter if you're an elephant or a lion on the savannah, if you go near their little pond where they're sitting, they will actually launch at you. And they have these, they're not teeth, they're extensions of their jawbone that are quite sharp. Like one of the worst bites I ever got was off an African bullfrog. Wow. It's like, it's really, it's nasty and it feels, you'll feel it, like, you know. But also when their little ponds are drying out, baking under the sun, they'll actually dig a canal to a bigger water source.
Wow.
And push all their tadpoles along. Now, you wouldn't associate that with frogs or amphibians or anything cold-blooded, but that's a really cool trick that they do. And
wow.
I think they're cool.
What are the cool tricks do our guys have?
Well, now that Collie started it, right? This is when we start these massive nerd-offs, and nearly everybody, like usually if we're having a few points, everybody kind of wanders off then. It's just me and him talking to each other, shouting about frogs. But frogs are fantastic in that males do a huge amount of looking after the young. Because everybody just goes, oh, it's always the females, like look at birds and look at this. But frogs are fantastic. Like you get a lot of males that will, like from everything from tiny little dart frogs up to big Taiwanese tree frogs, and then these huge pixie frogs in Africa where the males actually care for the tadpoles and look after them and ensure they're safe. And even glass frogs in Costa Rica, it's generally the males that will go down to the river and then they'll fill up their bladder, they'll drink water, and then they'll go up and they'll pee on the eggs to keep them moist.
Oh, wow.
They'll chase off these parasitic wasps. Mm. And then they also monitor the eggs to make sure that like there's no mold, and stuff, because in the rainforest it's quite humid and moist. They actually monitor the eggs for signs of mold growth, and I think they just wee more on them if they're mold growth. So males do a huge amount in the amphibian world, especially in the frog world.
Are those the ones that also the frogs you're talking about there with the parasitic wasps attacking the spawn, are they the ones that the spawn has evolved to jump out of the...
Early release.
Is that the same ones? Yeah.
Yeah. So, what they got all the evidence for this is from the red-eyed tree frog family. So the Spirellis, yes. These gliding red-eyed tree frogs, which are amazing, and it seems to be that the females lay this egg clump on a leaf overhanging water because the tadpoles want to go down into the water. But if you get these cat-eyed snakes that are there, the Leptodeiris, and they tend to stick their face into the clump and they'll eat the embryos, because the embryos is nutritious, like the jelly is actually water and some lipids and it's a bit rubbish, so they'll stick their face in. But snakes, when they move on branches, make a certain vibration. Parasitic wasps, when they sit on the leaf, will make a certain vibration that's not daddy keeping an eye on them, and it's not the wind.
Yep.
Or it's not a bigger animal just hitting them by accident.
Yeah.
And once this frequency is hit and the vibrations, it triggers the tadpoles to drop out of the eggs early.
Wow.
So it's an early release mechanism. It's a defensive mechanism. Wow. And they still have enough of the yolk as they're developing to just continue and keep on growing once they hit the water. So they're free from that predator. Now, doesn't mean they're free from aquatic predators, but they've just saved themselves getting absolutely destroyed. Wow. By a snake or a parasitic wasp or... you know, anything else that's having to go. But it has to be of certain frequencies. Mm. This American guys have done some really cool stuff on that.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's awesome. Like, what people tend to just write off as just as a frog, and they just do this. Just is one of those words where it's infinitely complex.
You could literally talk for hours about the different, again, like what we've talked about before on the podcast. It's like the different ways of surviving and getting through life and how they've evolved, these multitudes of ways to make it through the world. And it's really, really interesting. Again, we've had many a pint and many a chat over
give me more stories then, we have time.
No, because we do this thing, right? It's usually all of our friends are looking at us going, ah, lads, you said it wouldn't happen this time. It always does. It even happened on Thursday there when we're having pints. You know, no matter what you're looking at, then Collier go, oh yeah, well, I saw this in Africa, or I said, oh, I'd see it in the Neotropics. And then someone, like one of our mates, may say something. And then you realise that the same thing is happening. So it's the same strategy, no matter whether it's reproductive or it's defence or whatever.
It's
happening
species.
Everywhere. Yeah, it's all this parallel evolution. Yeah. And you've got it happening in these completely unrelated frogs doing a very similar thing in the Neotropics and a very similar thing in Asia and a very similar thing in Africa. And it's amazing. And then we go off and have this massive nerdgasm. And everyone's like, lads, we just don't understand this at all. But like, it's super exciting.
Yeah.
And there's so much that we still don't know.
Yeah.
And the scary thing is as well, and this is where we have to get into the sad bit of the conversation, the scary bit is there's so much we don't know, and we're losing so many frogs before we even really discover them.
Mm.
And this is why I want to ask you a couple of questions. What's the biggest nasty that's out there affecting frogs worldwide?
My opinion, it has to be loss of habitat and fragmentation. Has to be. And I think a really important point is that, like, we see ourselves as a Western country and we're developed and it's all wonderful. We are absolutely no different from any other developing nation. If you look at Ireland, just in terms, and this is me not being political, but just me just being me, we're heavily reliant on agriculture. So we're quite an agricultural country, like a lot of these developing nations are. So agricultural intensification, habitat and land use change is exactly what's affecting huge numbers of species abroad and is affecting our small, less than a handful of species here. And that's by far the biggest threat to amphibian populations. Then you throw in the big diseases now, so like the rhinoviruses, which are particularly nasty, the chytrid fungus, which is a mutated viral strain that's kind of conquered the globe and wiped out populations, you know. And then remember the old...
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hole in the ozone layer.
Oh yeah.
Intensification of UV. That's still a threat to frogs. Never mind pollution and just constant stressors. Road salt in winter.
Really?
Climate change. Driving amphibians that live on mountaintops, all of a sudden their moist mountaintop isn't so moist anymore because of climate change.
What does the road salt do?
Road salt is crazy in that when it gets washed into these little streams, what it tends to do is cause a sex reversal because it's not like table salt. It's different kind of salt. So there's different chemicals in it. And what that can do is it can make frog tadpoles shift sex as they're developing. Now, on the other hand of that, atrazine and all those nice chemicals that we find in pesticides, weed killers like Roundup, will cause a different shift to the opposite sex. So what you can have is a balancing of road salt affecting your frog population in one way and then the atrazine affecting it the other way. So then you can end up with these weird sex changes being induced by chemicals. It's chemically induced sex change. So when you're out on gritted roads, there's potentially an effect in the immediate area. Now, it doesn't spread like very far and wide, but in the immediate area of the having a... Like, it's essentially, it's a form of pollution, but it's one that can actually change the sex of your frogs.
Oh, God, so, humans,
you know, so small things that people tend to ignore can have big impacts. But on the converse side of that, small actions that people can do can have a massive impact. Put a pond in your garden, even if it's a washing tub, which are for your cups, you want to get a new one, bury that in your garden, let it fill with rainwater. And like we've seen frogs, next door actually is a fantastic one. Child's slide overturned in the wind, caught the rain on the curve. Frog went in and laid a clump of spawn and the curve rent was what, less than an inch and a half of water in it?
Wow.
With a crisp potato crisp bag from like 1987.
Photographs,
yeah, it's amazing.
My neighbours were like, is there something that looks like, is that frog spawn in our garden? And I was like, let me have a look. In a piece of plastic discarded there for years. And it was a great photograph actually because it goes to show how adaptive they were.
Yeah.
Like, because they couldn't gain access into my garden. So they were like, well, this'll do. And viable eggs.
But when the frog is in this plastic bag or whatever, does it have a place then to live? Can it find
the rest
a place?
Of the garden. The water isn't really important. The water is only important for spawning.
Yeah.
And that's for 3 weeks of the year. What's it doing for the other kind of 49 weeks of the year. It's on the land, stuffing its face usually, because like most frogs, and if you look at Collie's lovely Argentinian frog there, it's essentially a head on a stomach. And most frogs are like that. It's particularly the big ranids, like the one we have here. Like, you give them something the size of a lunchbox or an ice cream box, and they'll breed in it once it's full of water. No problem. They don't care. Yeah. They just need water for the tadpoles to be able to swim and develop. That's it. You go into a bog ecosystem, frogs sit right bang in the middle of the food chain. So, like, and they're top predators. They'll eat anything they can fit in their mouth. So they'll eat anything below it and a couple of steps up the food chain above it as well. So they're massively important, and that's why you hear a lot of stuff where people say they're ecosystem indicators. So it means that if there's frogs, it usually means it's a good sign that the immediate area is healthy in some way, shape or form. So
I remember when we were growing up, a lot of the neighbours used to complain about bloody frog spawn every year, and they go in and clean out their ponds. It just seemed to be everywhere, and I cannot remember the last time I saw a frog spawn, or even the last time I saw a frog like in the back garden or whatever. So how do you guys count the number of frogs or individuals, or how do you keep an eye on the population?
There's a system. Basically, the guys in England came up with a great system where they have you look at a patch of clump of spawn, and you could have 5 or 6 meters of it. You measure it,
wow,
and then you have a vector for each clump of spawn, basically. So if you have...
like a square.
Yeah, exactly. And each one, you'll know roughly what size a mating pair would make. Measure your thing, divide it by that, and then you'll get a number of pair of breeding pairs. Now, again, you'll probably have more males than females, so it's only a rough estimate, but it does give you a good indication of what the numbers are. Like, we've been doing Bushy Park for the last couple of years, and you can, in places like that where they're kind of struggling, you can see individual clumps of spawn. So you might count 10 in an area this year, and then maybe next year it's 6 or 7, and then the following year it could be 5, and then you might get a bounce back. And you can, that's how we kind of we gauge the numbers, because it'd be impossible otherwise to go out and actually physically catch them, because they're quite elusive for the rest of the year, you know.
Yeah, but you're always working off a minimum population there. So when you're counting clumps of spawn, there has to be at least one male for every female there,
yeah,
if it's viable. And you can tell it's viable very quickly, because you'll tell whether it's fertilised, because you'll see that it's fully black embryo. The unfertilised still have the white pole, so it's black and white. And then again, as Collie says, you might go back to next year and there's twice that amount. And that's why it's so important to do these year on year, because you're looking, trends are important. Like, 1 year survey is essentially worthless unless you just like to go and take photographs of spawn and get into a ditch and measure spawn clumps that we have some weird fascination of doing. But like, so that's
a whole other podcast.
Yeah, I know, yeah. But in sites where, like, we've been worried initially and we've gone, oh, lads, this is looking bad here, and you can see that, like, a new housing estates have gone up, or the park has been isolated because now there's a new road or whatever, and you're like, shit. So then you look for other factors. You're like, right, well, we have to come back next year. And then you come back and you go, well, how much albino spawn are we getting? Because albino spawn is a really good indicator that your population, the recessive gene, so you're getting inbreeding.
Okay. Banjo players. Yeah, yeah. We call them banjo players.
So you've got Kalita's spawn. And so then, but then we might come back down the following year. So then you're into year 3 already. And you come back the third year and you look at it and you go, bloody hell, there's like 4 times the spawn there was since we started here. And that's all the recruitment. So, because you're always at a lag, because there's always adults who are too small to breed, and they're off in under your hedgerow, stuffing their face, and essentially all they're doing is essentially mouth with a giant stomach, and the whole objective is feed up and go and bang the following, you know, like when they're big enough to do it, and that's what they go and do, and then you see this, but they're a natural boom bust species. But this is why it's really important, because if you keep seeing that your numbers are dropping off and there's no sign of your boom year on the approach, that's when you need to get worried, especially when you start to see like more leucistic spawn, which is white tadpoles. The albino has more of a yellowy tinge, and you can see the pink eyes. The leucistic are white with black eyes still, and you start to see these weird genetic coloration changes happening, and then they become more prevalent, and that's when you know you need to, if someone has frogs in their garden, you need to start asking them, can they knock a block, which is something that me and Collie
knock a block.
Yeah, knock a block. So did we steal that name from somebody?
No, I came up with it, and then they stole it from us.
All right,
no,
thieves everywhere.
The idea basically is, because gardens used to be quite open in housing estates, and if you look at it from Google Maps, if you look down any housing estate, it looks like a park. because all the gardens are facing onto each other. And that was back in the 80s, that was the way it was. You might have a wooden fence or something, but now everybody has block walls, solid block walls. No movement for hedgehogs, you know, who aren't that nimble. Frogs, newts, they're the kind of animals that get stuck in these small isolated areas. So what we were suggesting is people just put one block out in their garden, and that allows access between multiple areas and just spreads out their, you know, the areas that they can mix up with other populations. You don't get banjo players. They all get to meet each other, and much more sources of food as well, which is, you know, it's a simple and effective way of... Our big goal is, because of the urban spread, is to try and make them comfortable with us. I think it's important, you know.
So take out one block at ground level and give
on
access.
On either side of your garden.
Yeah. On either side. So they can get in, get out and get through. Yeah. That makes sense. Those albino frog spawn.
They actually develop into albino-looking frogs. Yeah,
really.
Yeah, so we've taken some from some of our monitor sites, and we've put them into tubs to rear them. And what you have is that they develop perfectly. They're gorgeous, and we've got pictures of them. Like, it's fantastic. And you've got these beautiful white albino, beautiful white, or these kind of yellowy, pinky tinged tadpoles, and they're all swimming around. They look gorgeous. And then you go out one day, and they'll have crashed, just for no apparent reason. All your normal tadpoles
died
in the tubs. Yeah. Are still swimming around. They're all being fed the same thing. They're exposed to the same temperatures, water temperature, air temperature, everything. And all the white ones crash off. So we think that it's probably some weird genetic level, that their physiology isn't right, and they crash. But some of them always survive. And then, based on their diet, you can see that some of them change colour a little bit. Some of them become like a bit of a weird pea green, kind of a pale greeny colour. But they're still way more obvious than the normal ones. And then they're just, it's just free range for something like a blackbird or a heron, and you just come in and pick them off.
Stick out like a sore thumb. Yeah. And then...
the Kildare site story, when we got the call out there.
Yeah, it was nuts.
That was crazy. That was one of the maddest experiences. You go ahead and fill them in on that one.
We had a phone call from a local vet, and she was really worried. She was out walking her dog, and normally the site in Kildare bubbles. That's, and all the locals will tell you that it boils during the spring with how many frogs are in there hopping around. And they said, like, even at night by moonlight, you can see the disturbance of the water. It's nuts.
It's crazy.
So she said she'd been down with the dog, and it is like somebody had gone in with a bomb and dropped a grenade and killed all the frogs. There was like concentric, it was almost perfectly concentric rings around the pond of dead frogs everywhere.
God. When we pulled up in the car, we opened the door and we stood out. And it was, do you remember that scene in Platoon where like the helicopter's taken off? It was just a big, you imagine the pond was a crater and just bodies everywhere. And as we got closer, it was more intense.
Yeah. And some of them were dead, some of them were kind of still alive and moving around. But they were all very not good looking, not looking well, right? So we walked down to the, as because there's a nice mowing track right down to where it says deep water, don't drown. So we walked down there, and it was just insane. And we were looking at it going, lads, this, what the hell's going on here? Like, all kind of indications immediately, like, this is a disease outbreak. And we'd none before. And we'd just done the only disease screening project ever to be done on this island. We'd just done the year before. We're like, we didn't detect any of this nasty shit. What's going on? So we went and we did a rough count. And I think the average worked out like 296 or something. So it was about 300 dead frogs.
Oh, God.
Essentially, since from when the vet rang us the previous evening to when we got there, I was like, man, there's something not right here. But they weren't showing the very obvious signs of disease. Like, normally with something like ranavirus, it tends to be later in the year when the water's warmer. And they get a lot of hemorrhaging, so you see like a lot of blood under the skin. They're all pink and red. And with chytrid, they just kind of tend to be floating there, but there's obviously like the skin can look a bit crusty and weird.
What's chytrid?
So chytrid is this particularly nasty fungus that's essentially colonised the globe. They think it's an Asian strain that's, through the pet trade, has evolved into a more virulent strain. There's multiple strains, some of which aren't nasty to like the area of where it's from, so the frogs have kind of dealt with it, and they've got a very high resistance rather than immunity to it. You know, and they were worried because in certain places, like in Costa Rica, this fungus has essentially wiped out, made numerous species go extinct. The one that's normally kind of given a lot of the spotlight over it was the golden toad, in Monteverde. So that was kind of the big indicator that something wasn't right there. There's a second chytrid fungus, the salamander chytrid, which is the Latin name translates nicely to the salamander eater. And that's come from Asia. And they know it's come from Asia for sure. And that's been spread into Europe via the pet trade again. Mm. So when we went to investigate this massive frog death in Kildare, we were worried that now, even after doing the screening, we were a year late. We didn't detect it, which was fantastic. But now all of a sudden, what the hell's going on here? So we had a look around. We did counts. We took measurements. We collected animals. We sent them to ZSL, because the Zoological Society of London, those guys there, their lab is primed for disease analysis, so they're the best people to do it. So we sent the carcasses to them for investigation. You know, we told Parks and Wildlife that this was happening and that we'd keep them up to date and informed what was going on. And it was just insane. So we estimate just on the death toll alone that one small pond, which people use for exercising their dogs, the local sheep use it for watering, must have held at least 1,000 individuals during breeding season. So, wow. Quite small ponds, very, very productive. So we suspected chytrid, but we were also very worried about a kind of a weird kind of bout of rhinovirus at the wrong time of year, because it had been a weird, unusual winter anyway, and it had been very warm during December, and maybe the water was holding the temperature slightly higher than it would. And then all of it came back, and usually it's just said that there's no disease there. We've done the necropsies, which were suggesting disease, but that could be from anything. Mm. Like, that was another thing. The crows weren't eating the carcasses.
Yeah, we were. That was the real alarm bells, because there were so many half-eaten or not-touched carcasses around. Yeah. So we were thinking, it has to be something funky. And it turned out to be.
We were like, this is nuts. But what it looks like, it sounds to be, and we're going to have to write this up at some point, is that it's likely to have been a mammal, probably a ferret, somebody's pet, that went and wiped them all out.
Like, actually, and just killed physically.
Yeah, so ferrets are nuts, right? All the mustelids are fantastic animals. And if I wasn't a herpetologist person, I would want to study mustelids, because they're crazy. So what we think was, there's anecdotal reports of somebody seeing two ferrets around the area. So somebody's pets who were escaped are intentionally released because they didn't want them anymore, because they can be a bit smelly and aggressive, but they're awesome. And what ferrets do when there's so much prey available, they go into a killing frenzy. Mm-hmm. Like they do when they get into chicken coops with stoats and things like that. So we think that based on puncture wounds on the back of the head, which is very indicative of a ferret, we did all this nerdy stuff, like we measured the distance between the puncture marks and the shoulders and the shoulder girdle in the back of the head. And usually you've got this table that you can compare it to and go, well, if it's between this and this, it's stoat. And anything bigger than that is suggestive of a ferret. So we are dealing with a really big stoat, which is not really from the area where we are, because it's quite urban. So it's likely to have been a ferret. And then people had seen ferrets there. And we were like, shit, this is just a feeding frenzy. Mm. And it's, again, they'll kill loads. Mm. To order to stash it and come back later. Mm. And it's because it's a impulsive thing.
Like a fox goes into a chicken coop, movement. Yeah. It's primed to just go for that movement.
Yeah.
And then there's another chicken, it goes for that, and another chicken, and it goes for that. So this loop of movement and kill and movement and kill is just... And, you know, they're not evil like people think, they're in to kill all the chickens.
They're just doing what they do, and it's just the excitement, and probably they get a little adrenaline rush, like, yo, happy days, look at all this food, and then... It's like a glut almost of, and the great thing is, though, like, we've been back 3 years after that each year, and the population's straight back up, and no more instance of this. We did find one cool thing. We found a frog sitting in the grass, and we're like, he looks very odd. And you can imagine a frog with just his front arms and his head popping out of the grass, and he looked perfectly fine. And then I went to lift him up, and he'd been eaten in half from the bottom. Oh. So it was we reckon it was a small mammal, a shrew. Yeah, had pulled him in to a hole and just ate his legs and just left him there.
It's like that clip in Jaws. You know, Robert Shaw's talking about them floating around in the sea, and the tiger sharks coming in, and he touched his mate in the shoulder, and he bobbed up and down, and been bitten in half below
like
the waist.
So
exactly
cool.
Like that. Yeah.
It was kind of an amazing experience to see that. And it was worrying at the time, but now we can kind of look back at it and go, wow, I think it was our first major big predation incident that we'd come across. Like, and you do hear them all the time, like the exploding toads in Germany and that kind of stuff, you know.
But exploding toads, explain that now.
Yeah, so there was a small pond again in a German village, and people were walking along and watching these distressed looking toads popping and finding with their guts hanging out and all this kind of thing. They couldn't figure it out. They got a herpetologist near, like ourselves, in, who set up camp and watched it for a while. And what he noticed was, if you look at a toad on its back, it has its bufotoxin glands, which are really like full of nasty chemicals and stuff like that. But the covids, the local crows and magpies, were copping on to how to get some tasty treats out of these toads. So what they were doing was they were flipping them on their backs and pulling their livers out. And what happens when a toad is stressed? It puffs itself up. And you puff yourself up and there's a hole in your side, boom, all your guts come out.
Wow.
And that's essentially what was happening. And it's a really, really interesting little study. And you can almost imagine, though, if science hadn't been around, imagine that was happening in the 1800s, something like that. Yeah. Somebody would have gotten burnt over that. Somebody would have been, she's a witch, you know. But yeah, it was a really cool little kind of, and to show how intelligent COVIDs are, you know what I mean? Which, yeah. To figure that out. So, before we continue on this brilliant conversation, nerding out over frogs, maybe we'll take a break and come back in a couple of weeks and talk about the pet trade and habitat creation and all that good stuff in our own country. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, sounds great. I think we've done it again. Sorry, Colette.
There will be some good news, though, will there?
There's always good news. Yeah, we're going to have some good news. We'll cheer you up. Don't worry. Next time we have a frog nerd gasm.
Brilliant. Absolutely. Frog nerd gasm. I like that.
Yeah.
Cool. Thanks a million, Rob.
Cheers.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.